From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, NPR music critic Ann Powers schools me on why Carly Rae Jepsen belongs on a list of the best 21st century songs from female artists.
She has created a sound and a way of deploying her voice that is so distinctive, and Call Me Maybe really had a significant historical impact.
Then Leonard Maltin says farewell to the Fox movie lot as the studio is bought by Disney.
When you saw a Fox movie and heard that majestic music, you know, you okay, let's see something good.
All that coming right up. When it comes to the representation of women in music, the numbers, sadly, are really grim. True, Cardi B, Taylor Swift, and Beyoncé have dominated the charts recently, but last year, the Billboard Hot 100 charts reached a 25-year low for female artists. Spotify's 2017 year-end playlist of the most streamed artists featured zero women, and at the 2017 Grammy Awards, dubbed hashtag Grammys So Male, more than 90% of the nominees were men. So last week, when NPR released its 200 Greatest Songs by 21st Century Women Plus, the intentions were more pointed than your typical clickbait list. The list was organized by NPR music critic Ann Powers, and the songs were compiled from a poll that surveyed the most prominent women in music criticism. The list features women of all genres, from pop, rock, hip-hop, jazz, and classical, and it shows how some prominent musicians have influenced women who follow in their wake. But the list also reveals how hard it is for female artists to have lengthy careers. When I spoke with Powers, we began with the genesis of NPR's music initiative called Turning the Tables.
A few years ago, my good friend Jill Sternheimer, who is the director of public programs at Lincoln Center, she and I were hanging out in New Orleans, and we had just gone to see Barbara Lynn, the great guitarist. And we were reflecting upon how women like Barbara Lynn are sort of forgotten in the annals of rock and roll and pop history, and started to talk about what could we do, to celebrate these women, to correct the historical record. And that evolved into an idea to create a list of the 150 greatest albums by women of the recording era. We did that last year. Joni Mitchell's Blue was at the top. There was quite a bit of enthusiasm throughout the cybersphere, and that inspired us to move forward and do this year's project, which is focused on 21st century women, an attempt to capture history in the making, this very moment that we live in.
These are songs that are performed by women and some non-binary or trans performers. But there were also songs selected by women. So how important was that to you to highlight female voices in criticism?
Absolutely crucial, and I'm so glad you asked about that. We are living in just like a glorious time for women writing about music. It is a golden age, in my opinion. And so many women who are among my favorite writers, Lindsay Zoladz at The Ringer, Amanda Petrosich at The New Yorker, Susie Exposito at Rolling Stone, Jill Mapes at Pitchfork, all of these amazing women really changing the face of music writing, you know, and of cultural criticism in general. They are the ones who are rewriting the record and rewriting history on a day-to-day basis. So we invited not only women from throughout the NPR system, hosts, producers, writers, but also a select group of these elite writers to participate in our poll.
For this latest piece, you focused on songs written between 2000 and 2018. When you step back and look at the songs that were selected, do you see some narratives unfolding over the early part of the 21st century?
These songs bring back visceral memories in a way that perhaps the songs from our first list, which, you know, range from 1964 to nearly the present, didn't for everyone. But when I look at especially the top of the list, so MIA's Paper Planes is number one. Yeah, Yeah, Yeah's Maps is number two. Single Ladies by Beyonce is number three. Back to Black by Amy Winehouse is number four. Hold On by the Alabama Shakes is number five. Each of those songs entered my life in a particular moment. And I can go back to that place. I can go back to the place in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, where I lived when the Alabama Shakes emerged. And I was driving around near the river in Tuscaloosa, singing at the top of my lungs with Brittany Howard, Hold On, Brittany. You know, those memories are so alive. And I think that's a treat that this list offers that maybe the last list didn't.
The other thing that I would suggest is evident is how some musicians influence and shape musicians who follow. I'm going to play number eight on your list. It's Alicia Keys' song, Fallen.
I keep on falling.
So when you listen to that song, I think you can hear how a narrow genre has evolved. Do you notice that too, how one artist has influenced others and how those artists are carrying a tradition that was set down earlier by somebody who preceded them?
Absolutely. You know, I published an essay in connection to this list about women on what we're calling the cusp of the 21st century. People like Missy Elliott, Christina Aguilera, Gillian Welch in Americana, Nico Case in indie music. These women, they are sort of the spiritual mothers and aunties of the women who are performing today. Now, with that Alicia Keys example, I think you definitely hear the way that her music is a bridge between classic soul, you know, the Aretha sound, and today's almost more experimental artists like SZA or Jenny Aiko, who are both on this list also. Through Alicia, an artist like her, hip-hop enters, a little bit of a hip-hop undercurrent, but you still have that emotionalism and gospelized feeling of classic soul. It all adds up. It all is a golden road to the present day.
Now, let's get back to my conversation with NPR music critic Ann Powers. As part of a new NPR initiative, Powers organized a group of music writers to create a list of 200 songs by the 21st century's most influential women and gender non-binary musicians. The song you're hearing is Maps, sung by Karen O of Yeah Yeah Yeahs, and Powers explains why this song made it all the way to number two on the list.
When you think of the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, you immediately think of Maps. When you think of someone like, say, Rihanna, you might think of Stay, you might think of We Found Love, you might think of Umbrella. There's so many different ones, different songs that all seem, similarly amazing. So the list does favor those songs that, you know, stand out in an artist's catalog. But I'll also say that Maps is formative, and Karen O's vulnerability and rawness, the way she blends those elements in her vocalizing, the kind of cool in her vocalizing as well. I think you hear that in so many artists today. And it's also worth noting that Beyonce sampled Maps in her song Hold Up from Lemonade. So this song also connects indie rock to hip hop and R&B.
I want to ask you a question about Beyonce, and it's really about staying power. Crazy in Love came out in 2003, and yet she's still the dominant voice, not only among women, but also, I think you could argue, for all performers. How hard, or is it harder for a woman to have staying power than it is for a man? Is the turnover much higher for female artists than it might be for their male counterparts?
I think women do have to work harder to earn their immortality in popular music. And, you know, you consider an artist like Beyoncé, she has innumerable great songs. She also is one of the great dancers of our times. She creates the most compelling visuals, the most compelling tours. She is a fashion icon. She has redefined what it is to have a celebrity marriage. She's a master of social media. As opposed to, say, John Mayer, who just, you know, kind of lays back and plays his guitar and tours with the dead and also gets to be immortal. So, you know, give it to the women as usual. We're working to the bone to claim our glory. And Beyoncé is our example. You know, Beyoncé also stands for something, which is that sense of effort, that sense of determination, that sense of, you know, I am a superwoman, but you can see the tracks in the sand that took me to this place. And I feel like that's sort of part of the zeitgeist right now, is women are demanding to be acknowledged for how hard they work and, you know, what their ambitions are and how they put in the labor to achieve. And she captures that so perfectly.
There are some songs on the list that will be inevitably polarizing. Rihanna makes a few appearances, but so does the woman who performed this song, which is ranked number 21. It's radio, so you can't see me cringing. That's Carly Rae Jepsen. Not a song say is profound or very original unless you're a 14-year-old girl. So how does the voting process work? And is it inevitable that there are going to be some songs that somebody will say, how in the world is that on the list?
Well, this is where I just tell you are dead wrong, John. Carly Rae Jepsen emblematizes something that's happened in pop music in the 21st century. She is a true artist of dance pop. She has created a sound and a way of deploying her voice that is so distinctive. And Call Me Maybe, you know, it's just one of those songs that anytime you hear a note of it, people come together to sing it. You know, it was a viral phenomenon on YouTube with all different kinds of people making lip sync videos to it. It really had a significant historical impact. There is a through line in this list because women have always been somewhat disrespected in music history because they often make what we call pop music. Now, what even is pop music? Pop music is what's popular, right? I mean, Nirvana was pop music on some level. But we're talking about music for the dance floor, music that sounds good when you're walking through the mall, music that you are happy when it comes up on your playlist and you're not deep in thought necessarily about reading liner notes like people did with Pink Floyd or something. Pop music is an art. And Pink, Carly Rae Jepsen, Robin, Rihanna, these artists have shown us how much elegance, how much emotion, how much depth you can bring to the form. I think there's no controversy to it. I think it is the heart of the best of pop music.
You make the argument, and the list makes the argument, I think, too, that women are responsible for shaping the sound of 21st century music. But in a recent study conducted by Stacey Smith at USC's Annenberg Inclusion Initiative, she found that of the top 600 songs from 2012 to 2017, defined by Billboard's year-end Hot 100 chart, for each of those years, of 1,239 performing artists, fewer than a quarter of them were women, 22.4%. And it's even worse when you look at songwriting and producing. Why is that?
Well, the music industry is a patriarchal mess. I mean, the music industry also was shaped by significant women, but in fewer numbers than men, certainly. The business side of music, and that includes radio, and now it includes streaming services, really has favored male artists, largely because it was constructed as a boys' club. This is especially true after rock and roll comes in. If you look at the Billboard charts just previous to Elvis's emergence in the late 1950s, there are many more women on the charts than just after his emergence. A shift happened, and unfortunately, it's still correcting itself, or maybe not. Liz Pelly, who is one of our voters, contributors to this list, has written eloquently about how streaming services are replicating the sins of radio and favoring male artists. And I do not believe that it is what listeners desire. I believe it is embedded in the structure of radio, in the structure now of streaming playlists to favor male artists. And it really comes directly from individual people, individual men who say that women don't want to hear other women and men don't want to hear women. But it's just not true.
Yeah, I want to ask more about the segregation and streaming services, because if you look at Spotify, they have playlists for every kind of genre, and then a lot of playlists that are designed to highlight women in a specific genre. So it's women in rock, women in pop, women in hip hop. But do you think there's a better way of looking at that rather than segregating women within a genre as and just say, here are some good songs in pop, some good songs in hip hop? Does that segregation, do you think, help or hurt the cause?
Well, certainly the phrase women in fill in the blank has become a cliche and also an endless source of this kind of false novelty. You know, when you define the presence of a woman as a novelty, then history can't take hold. You know, legacies can't take hold. You know, it's always new, right? I mean, we act like it's always new. Oh, wow, unbelievable, you know, that there's, I don't know, great indie rock being made by bands like Waxahachie. You know, how did that happen? Well, this is why we are working to correct the canon. We are working to educate people and to show what is hidden in plain sight and in plain earshot, which is that women have been making this history for so long, you know. And one thing I love about our playlist is that it is very deliberately multi-genre and includes classical music and jazz and global music and, you know, every variety of music. And I think those songs really speak to each other across the genres and showing that, you know, women's voices can't be confined to a genre, can't be confined to any one particular category.
As we go out, I want to play the number one song on the list. It's MIA's 2007 song, Paper Planes.
Sometimes I think sitting on trains. Every step I get to, I'm clocking that game. Everyone's a winner, we're making our fame. Bonafide hustler, making my name.
So tell us a little bit about why you think this song is number one, and does it deserve to be number one?
I love this song. The minute I hear this song, I wake up. And I think it sounds as fresh and relevant as it ever has. You know, she represents a kind of global insurgency in pop music and a global awareness of the place of immigrants, the place of the developing world, the place of people of color. At the same time, the production on this song and her voice, it is just so engaging and fun, and it's deep and fun at the same time, which is what great pop music is all about. So I absolutely think it deserves to be at number one. It's a song that will never stop shocking us and thrilling us.
Ann Powers is NPR's music critic. She was talking with us about the 200 greatest songs by 21st century women plus. Ann, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Anytime.
Hit me on my banner, prepaid wireless. We pack and deliver like UPS trucks. Already going hell, just pumping that gas.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The $71 billion sale of 21st Century Fox to Disney officially was approved by shareholders in the two media giants last week. As one of the most iconic Hollywood studios, Fox released many landmark films, including Planet of the Apes, The Sound of Music, Star Wars, and Avatar, which is still the highest-grossing movie ever. Film critic, historian, and author Leonard Maltin wrote an essay in memoriam to the studio. his Hollywood Reporter article, Death of a Hollywood Studio, A Eulogy for 20th Century Fox, was published today, and Maltin interrupted his vacation for a phone call about Fox's history. And I started by asking him why MGM studio chief Louis B. Mayer helped finance what was originally 20th Century Pictures. Apparently, Mayer was looking for a job for his son-in-law, William Goetz, but not at MGM.
His other son-in-law was David O. Selznick. And Selznick was at that time the production chief of RKO. And he just wanted his son to appear successful on his own, so to speak. And so he didn't want to just give him a job at the family business. So he created a new family business that was more indirect.
So how did 20th Century, in its earliest years, become a rival to studios like MGM? What put it on the map?
In short, Daryl F. Zanuck. Daryl Zanuck had been the head of production at Warner Brothers in the early 1930s. He's the guy who gave Warner Brothers its reputation for tough, gritty films torn from today's headlines. The gangster films, like The Public Enemy and Little Caesar, and really topical, hard-hitting films like I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang. That all came from Zanuck. But he and Harry Warner of the brothers had a kind of a falling out. And he was disaffected at this moment, so he was susceptible to a good offer.
What would you say Zanuck's taste was in actors, and how did he work with talent, for better and for worse?
Well, he had a good eye for talent, that's for sure. I don't know, you know, how closely one can credit him in each specific case, but he brought Henry Fonda out from Broadway to make his film debut and then signed him to a contract. He brought Don Ameche, who was a radio actor, out from Chicago, and I don't know how, decided to make a star out of Olympic figure skater Sonia Henie, and she was a very big star for a long time. So he did have a, if not a Midas touch, he had a certainly a great track record for building stars.
It seems odd now to call the studio 21st Century Fox. It was always 20th Century Fox to me, but it also wasn't Fox. It was 20th Century. So how did the Fox name become part of the studio?
Originally, the company that they formed with Zanuck as their production chief was called 20th Century Pictures. But after about a year of operation, they maneuvered a merger, I don't know if it's merger is quite the word, or takeover, of the Fox Film Company, which had begun in the teens by one of the real pioneers of the business, William Fox. William Fox fell on hard times. His appetite was larger than his ability to pay bills and such. He had a lot of personal misfortune in the early 30s. And so his studio was ripe for takeover. So they merged, and that's why there was a hyphen in the name for many years, 20th Century hyphen Fox.
One of the amazing things about the history of the studio is that they at one point owned essentially Century City, where with all of its hotels and high-rise office buildings and CAA, and yet they slowly kind of pared their real estate holdings at some point because of movies that weren't working, like Cleopatra. They were a land baron outside of a studio, too, weren't they?
Well, they were. Well, all the studios, or most of the studios, had what they called back lots. But a back lot in those days was a series of standing sets like a Western street, you know, or a European village. When 20th Century Fox made In Old Chicago about the Great Chicago Fire, that was all on the back lot. And they didn't have to, you know, set foot outside the perimeter of the studio. But in time, that real estate, which was vast, it ran from Santa Monica Boulevard down to Pico. And in time, they couldn't resist the lure of cash that it promised.
I want to play you a little bit of music that I think you have, like a lot of movie fans, a strong connection to. Let's listen to this music. So that is an early recording of the Fanfare for Fox, composed by Alfred Newman. It was written back in 1934. What does that theme mean to you? We obviously have heard different versions of it over the years, but how iconic to your ears is that fanfare?
It's emblematic of Hollywood. It's something that represents continuity as well in my life as a moviegoer. Paramount and most of the others didn't have themes. Universal has one now, but gosh, you know, when you saw a Fox movie and heard that majestic music, you know, you were okay, let's see something good. And it was extended when Fox embraced CinemaScope in 1953, along with stereophonic sound. They had Alfred Newman write a sort of a second half of the fanfare with some strings. And now that's all one seamless piece of music that we all know and I think love.
I remember when Baz Luhrmann was working on Moulin Rouge at the beginning of the film, he had a little conductor conducting the Fox fanfare, and the studio said, "You can't do that. You can't touch the fanfare." So I hope Disney has as much respect for the fanfare as the studio did. Leonard Maltin is the author of the article "Death of a Hollywood Studio: A Eulogy for 20th Century Fox." It's available at the HollywoodReporter.com website. You can also see some great pictures of the studio's history. Leonard, thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure, John.
And that will do it for today. I'm John Horn. We'll be back here tomorrow.